Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ben Norton, a freelance journalist, who discusses how a flawed news story assisted opponents of the international Iran nuclear deal to spread disinformation about the accord. Veteran community organizer G2 Brown, who talks about why he's joined 11 other parents, teachers, and activists participating in a hunger strike to save Diet High School in Chicago's South Side. And author and activist Norman Solomon, who explains the goals of a RootsAction.org petition drive launched to pressure presidential candidate Bernie Sanders to reveal details of his foreign policy platform. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Violent protests erupted in Nepal's marginalized indigenous communities as police attacked opponents marching against a new national constitution. 8 police officers were killed in western Nepal in the city of Tikapur, 260 miles west of the capital city of Kathmandu, as police sought to keep protesters away from government buildings. Before protesters clashed with police in Tikapur, 4 marchers had died after being assaulted by police. Since the new constitution was proposed in mid-August, indigenous communities, including the Tharau ethnic minority, have organized protests, fearing they would lose political representation under the new district system. Tharau ethnic community activists are seeking a separate state in the new constitution. The Guardian newspaper reports that the Tharau minority has struggled to overcome decades spent as bonded slaves to high-caste landowners. For years, Nepal has been governed by an interim constitution. But now there is a sense of urgency for a new constitution in rebuilding after the massive earthquake in April. Human Rights Watch has called for an independent investigation of the deaths in recent protests. Overall, the New York-based Human Rights Monitor blames the Nepalese government for failing to engage with the local community and address its concerns. After this spring's failure to win new rent protections in the New York State Legislature, tenant activists in gentrified Brooklyn are testing out new organizing models to promote affordable housing. In the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, activists are borrowing collective bargaining techniques from labor unions to win concessions from developers. Activists are now pressing to put binding rent protection agreements directly into building deeds. The ultimate goal of the Crown Heights Tenant Union is to create a neighborhood-wide compact between landlords and tenants in order to regulate rent increases and to set standards for repairs and renovations. The tenant union came close to winning an argument with the private equity firm Burke Layton, which owns 4 buildings in Crown Heights, but it fell apart after the buildings were sold to a new real estate company. That experience, says tenant organizer Joel Feingold, led the group to look at collective bargaining strategies to save housing for the entire neighborhood. Over the past 5 years, new landlords, often backed by large Wall Street private equity firms, have flooded the neighborhood, buying up buildings and filling them with new residents who often pay 3 or 4 times the existing rent. To force old residents to leave, landlords sometimes engage in harassment campaigns and illegal tactics. According to the news magazine In These Times, the Crown Heights Tenant Union has grown exponentially in less than 2 years. Feingold sees this as a sign that the union model is able to gain residents' trust, a crucial challenge for affordable housing groups across the country. In San Francisco, it took a brief 2-minute consultation for Jeff Harrington to sign up as a medical marijuana patient and so legally purchase cannabis. Across the country in Connecticut, an established patient-physician relationship is required for prescribing medical marijuana. Further, marijuana can only be dispensed by a licensed pharmacist. The Center for Public Integrity reports there are multiple standards for prescribing medical marijuana in 23 states and the District of Columbia that run medical marijuana programs. Meanwhile, the federal government continues to classify marijuana as a controlled Schedule I drug and refuses to offer guidance to state-run medical marijuana programs. Schedule I drugs, which include heroin, LSD, ecstasy, and peyote, are classified as having a high potential for abuse and having no currently accepted medical use. State medical cannabis programs vary greatly. In Vermont, for example, a medical marijuana patient is allowed to have 2 mature marijuana plants and possess 2 ounces of pot. In Washington state, a patient can have 15 marijuana plants and 24 ounces of pot. States also vary on which medical diagnoses qualify for marijuana treatment. Most states cover AIDS, cancer and chronic pain, but only New Hampshire covers marijuana treatment for traumatic brain injuries. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The international agreement designed to limit Iran's nuclear capabilities to peaceful civilian purposes in exchange for the lifting of economic sanctions will face a critical vote in the U.S. Congress sometime in September. Opponents of the accord are working hard to gain support in both the House and Senate. Legislators who want to derail the agreement must first get 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster by lawmakers who support the deal. But if they win that battle, opponents would still have to secure the votes cast by two-thirds of the lawmakers in both chambers in order to override a promised presidential veto. In this high-stakes debate, groups that oppose the nuclear agreement include the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and their affiliated organization, Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran. These groups are expected to spend more than $40 million in advertising, social media, and direct mail to sway public opinion and pressure legislators. Into this volatile political environment, the Associated Press published a story on August 19th that erroneously reported that a side agreement between the International Atomic Energy Agency and Iran allows the Islamic Republic to inspect its own Parchin military base. Although the AP later corrected their story, corporate and conservative media outlets repeated the flawed information far and wide. Your reporter spoke with Ben Norton, a freelance journalist and author of a recent article that examines the debunked myths disseminated in the U.S. media and the effect it's had on public support for the Iran nuclear agreement.
In my piece, I talk about like two main myths here. The first is that there were these secret side deals in the first place. I think it needs to be recognized that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, noted in an official statement in July when the deal was first reached that it had made side deals with Iran. They were not secret side deals. They were side deals. And beyond that, even the fact that they were not secret does not in many ways stop detractors from claiming that this is, you know, some kind of, you know, capitulation to Iran. But actually, when you look at the semantics of these side deals and things like that, and when you look at the details, they're actually no different from the kinds of deals that the IAEA has made with other nations. And in fact, the director general of the IAEA, his name is Yukiya Amano, released a statement the day after the AP article was published and said that the side deals they made with Iran was just customary. It is the same kind of side deals the IAEA makes with any country in order to investigate a country's potentially confidential military technology and things like that. The IAEA has to speak with that country alone. They can't just release all that country's private information to the rest of the world. So from the beginning, this was already a fabricated controversy. But even worse than that was the AP story took these rumors, which were already not substantiated in the first place, and said that part of the so-called secret side deal, even though it wasn't secret, it was announced in July, part of this side deal was supposedly that Iran was given essentially the right to investigate itself at its Parchin military base. And in fact, what actually happened, what the IAEA has done is they created a complex process. It's multi-tiered and has numerous levels of analysis and potentially even the involvement of U.S. nuclear scientists. And these different levels are going to be investigating in different labs. And one of the levels allows Iranian scientists to take samples of their own lab. So this was essentially distorted and taken out of context and kind of blown up to this fabricated controversy that says, oh no, Iran has these secret side deals we haven't heard about, and oh no, in these side deals, Iran was supposedly allowed to investigate itself. And it bears mentioning that AP edited the story that it published on the 19th of August. And if you look at the draft now, it does not have any of these previous accusations. So that is essentially an implicit admittance by AP that what it had reported was inaccurate.
Ben, just a final question. We only have a minute or two left.
But it seems that when the nuclear agreement with Iran was first announced, it had pretty substantial public support here in the U.S. But I've seen recent public opinion polls where that support has slipped, and I'm sure in no small measure due to the $40 million being spent by opponents on these negative TV ads, encouraging the public to be skeptical and frightened of this deal. What can you tell us about this turnaround in public opinion?
Well, as you mentioned, one of the earliest polls, which was taken in late July, and the one that kind of circulated the most, found that 54% of Americans were in support of the deal and 38 were against and 8 abstained. So that was very significant support. And as you mentioned, it has slipped since then for a variety of reasons, largely because of misinformation and such. So I think that alone shows that, you know, this misinformation is working. And we should recognize that a large amount of money is being funneled into this. I mentioned AIPAC, the pro-Israel group. They formed a sister group called Citizens for a Nuclear Free Iran, and they are the ones who expect to spend up to $40 million. And there's a group, J Street, which is a liberal group that supports Israel and is, you know, more aligned with the Democratic Party, and they're only planning on spending $5 million. So there's an 8-to-1 ratio here. There's a large amount of money going into, you know, ads, as you mentioned, and a variety of other things, even lobbying different members of Congress to oppose the deal. So there's a lot of money being thrown around in an attempt to turn public opinion against the deal. But at the same time, we should recognize that many Americans still are in support of it, and the vast majority of the world is in support of it. You know, there have been polls done of French and British public opinion, and the vast majority of people support the deal.
That was Ben Norton, a freelance journalist based in New York City, and author of the recent article titled, Media and Nuclear Deal Opponents Continue to Spread Debunked Myth, Iran Will Monitor Itself. Find more discussion on corporate media coverage of the Iran nuclear deal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On August 17th, a group of black parents on the south side of Chicago, along with a few teachers and other supporters, 12 in all, began a hunger strike to stop the privatization of public education in Chicago and advocate for their vision of what a good neighborhood public high school could be. They've been protesting in front of the recently closed Diet High School, demanding that the Chicago School Board recognize their proposal to create a global leadership in green technology academy in the Bronzeville neighborhood, made up mostly of low-income African Americans. Chicago Public Schools put out a request for a proposal, or RFP, seeking plans for reopening the school, but rejected the community's submission. After the hunger strike began, the school board hinted that perhaps the school would not reopen at all. Strikers maintain that the school board and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel have responded positively to similar proposals made by parents in whiter, more affluent areas. Thus far, at least 2 hunger strikers have been briefly hospitalized while participating in the juice and water only fast. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with one of the hunger strikers, G2 Brown, national director with Journey for Justice Alliance, on the 12th day of the strike, shortly after American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten visited to lend her support. Here, Brown explains how their struggle relates to the mayor's closure of more than 50 Chicago public schools last June, with the rationale that they were under-enrolled and underperforming.
What we began to do with the core parents that were in the feeder schools is talk about what do we need to do to win with Walter Diet Global Leadership at Green Technology High School. We had went through really a process of about 3 years of developing a comprehensive plan, not just for Diet High School, but 6 of our feeder schools, what we call a sustainable community school village. We got the buy-in from those schools. They wanted to be a part of the process. And Chicago Public Schools basically, you know, gave us the runaround, lied, played misdirection with us. But I think the final straw was when there was supposed to be a hearing on August 10th. And we tried to get the location and the time of the hearing, and they would never answer. So finally, on August 7th at 4:30 p.m., we find a press release on CPS's website saying that the hearing is canceled and the board vote will not happen on August 26th. So that was the last straw. We had done everything else you can do. We had met with every bureaucrat. We had jumped over every hoop. We did sit-ins. We protested. We got arrested. Everything you can do, and even before that, engaged over 3,000 people in Bronzeville in support of this particular plan. We submitted this plan to the board in April of 2015. In response to that, instead of the board saying they would work with the community desire, they opened an RFP. And we felt that was discriminatory, but we made the decision to participate in it, but to pressure the district. Now, mind you, in other communities in the city of Chicago, Rogers Park, parents did not want Intrinsic and Noble Street Charter School. And these are middle-class white parents, and within 2 weeks, the deal was off the table. Parents in a community in Chicago called Hyde Park, a diverse group with a large number of white middle-class parents, wanted a closed school by the name of Cantor to relieve the overcrowding at Kenwood Academy. There was no RFP. They didn't have to do any protest. They didn't have to get arrested. 2.5 to 3 months, you know, the keys to Cantor were handed over to Kenwood Academy, and it became the 7th and 8th grade academy. So there is a two-tier system. There's a devaluing of the voices of African-American parents, and it's just the truth.
G2 Brown, what kind of support has the hunger strike gotten from the community?
It's amazing. I mean, I'll let you know in regards to when we're out in front of Diet, people come from all walks of life. You know, you get people in the neighborhood, a lot of people in the neighborhood. You get people that have just heard about it that you don't know that walk up to you and stay out, you know, and bring up bottles of juice and just say, you know, we really want to support what you're doing. Today we had a group of about 50 young people from the Albany Parkey neighborhood surround us and sing around us, you know, because the hunger strikers are beginning to get weak. You may know that two hunger strikers were hospitalized. They're both out now. Jeanette was released yesterday, so this is taking a toll physically. But support like that has helped, you know, bolster this effort. And in addition to that, what's happened on social media, we're very clear there's been a media blackout of this, but they can't stop it. So what's happened is, you know, we've trended on Twitter for 5 straight days. Facebook is, you know, is going crazy on Facebook. So what happens is people have been really pushing. And so the day before yesterday, we had an enormous press conference. Washington Post began to cover it. Al Jazeera covered it. So it's growing. And that's all due to people's support, because they realize it's not just about a high school. It's about school privatization in general. And that's what this is about. You know, Diet High School was not a failing school. We had our young people with a national trainer for restorative justice. Our young people were going to D.C., Baltimore, Philly, Oakland, California, training adults on how to implement restorative justice. We led the city for 2 straight years in reductions in arrests and suspensions. We had the largest increase of students going to college in the entire city. We had our science team routinely went to the state finals.
About 10 days into your hunger strike, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten came to Chicago to support your efforts. What's been the role of the local chapter of the teachers union regarding your hunger strike? I know they opposed Rahm Emanuel's massive school closures.
Well, I think the Chicago Teachers Union has been extremely supportive, and I think they personify a fighting union. As a matter of fact, two of the hunger strikers are teachers. They're teachers that live in the Bronzeville community. I think that this particular fight has been community-led, because that's what community fights should be. Then labor works with you. You know, labor supports. But the soul of this has been mothers and fathers.
That was veteran community organizer G2 Brown, one of 12 hunger strikers protesting outside Diet High School in Chicago's South Side. For more information on the group's organizing to improve public education in Chicago, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The presidential candidacy of Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders has caught fire across the U.S. Since his announcement on the shores of Lake Champlain on May 26th, the perception of the Brooklyn-born self-declared Democratic Socialist has undergone a dramatic transformation, from a long shot to a serious contender to win the Democratic Party nomination. Sanders has drawn the largest crowds of supporters to his events of any candidate, surpassing his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton and all other Republican contenders. Recent polls show Bernie ahead of Clinton in the early primary state of New Hampshire and gaining strength in the first caucus state, Iowa. While Senator Sanders has focused his campaign on confronting growing income inequality in the U.S. and offering policy prescriptions to take the country back from Wall Street vulture capitalists and the billionaire class, the longtime Vermont legislator has said relatively little about his foreign policy platform. A recent visit to his campaign website, in fact, finds no mention of foreign policy issues at all. The progressive activist group RootsAction.org recently launched an online petition drive that urges Sanders to speak out about the links between corporate power, militarism, and social justice, echoing what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. denounced as the madness of militarism. Here, Roots Action co-founder, author, and activist Norman Solomon explains the goal of the petition drive and reviews Senator Sanders' foreign policy voting record in the House and the Senate.
When it comes to challenging that status quo of economic inequality, of Wall Street power, of corporate dominance, of the insurance medical corporate complex, the hammerlock that the energy conglomerates have on fuel, energy, and climate policies, the whole raft of issues that Bernie Sanders sums up as a challenge to oligarchy, it really in many ways is unprecedented. I mean, I think you would have to go back to the 1988 campaign of Jesse Jackson to find one with so much political punch from a progressive standpoint and so much momentum. And I think it has really astonished the punditocracy within the Beltway and the corporate media to see the grassroots response and really mobilization that Bernie Sanders' campaign has been a catalyst for. So on that basis, I am very enthusiastic about the Bernie Sanders campaign for president. I personally support that campaign. At the same time, I think there are important reasons to go in with eyes very wide open and to, at the same time, be realistic about what the shortcomings are of his candidacy and his positions.
Your group, Roots Action, has launched this petition drive. What does it say exactly? What specifically are you urging Bernie Sanders to do?
More than 25,000 have already signed this petition, which is addressed to Bernie Sanders, and it first expresses enthusiasm for his challenge to corporate power in his presidential campaign, and then goes on to say that corporate power and militarism fuel each other. And it cites Martin Luther King Jr.'s statement about the madness of militarism and ends in a brief petition statement by urging Bernie Sanders to challenge the madness of militarism, to acknowledge and address how corporate power and Wall Street and so forth are intertwined with and fueling militarism and vice versa. And this petition, which gained momentum, it launched in August. It got more than 25,000 signers, and among them, more than 5,000 people took the time to write individual and often, I think, very eloquent statements, which are part of the petition, again, at rootsaction.org. And then at the end of August, we presented that petition, transmitted it directly to Bernie Sanders, care of his press secretary, and we got no response at all. The fact is that on many positions, from a progressive standpoint, Bernie Sanders either has been silent or when under questions he has responded. His policies towards the Middle East and towards what I think Dr. King would still call the madness of militarism, they're very inadequate. As a matter of fact, other than Bernie Sanders opposing the expansion of NATO, which is a commendable position, it's very difficult to find a significant difference between the foreign policy and war positions of Senator Bernie Sanders and President Barack Obama.
Norman Solomon, Bernie Sanders had long been a congressional representative in the House and more recently, of course, years in the U.S. Senate. What do we know about his voting record when it comes to foreign policy? Is there any pattern that we can discern from where he took positions on issues of war and peace and militarism in general?
Well, there is a pattern. I think it situates him on the more skeptical end of the spectrum towards war among congressional Democrats. He's one of the better Democrats from an anti-war progressive standpoint on Capitol Hill, but that's a pretty low bar, and frankly, he doesn't clear it by very much. He will point out when he's trying to lay out his credentials of being willing to oppose wars that are terrible ideas, that he did vote against the first Gulf War in 1991 against Iraq. He voted against the invasion of Iraq when that came to a vote in October 2002 in Congress. But on the other hand, he voted in favor of the U.S.-led NATO bombing of Kosovo in 1999, which caused such destruction in Serbia and Kosovo. He also has been echoing a lot of the fairly belligerent talk coming out of the Obama administration about Russia, about Putin, about the need to, we're told, isolate politically, economically, and diplomatically Putin of Russia. And to me, most disturbingly of all, Bernie Sanders, in his campaign for president in the last now just about 4 months, has repeatedly fallen back on a mantra that, as he puts it, the United States can't do it alone in the Middle East. And as Sanders goes on to say, and I'm quoting here, Saudi Arabia has to get its hands dirty, unquote. And the independent journalist Robert Perry said it very well a few days ago in a piece on consortiumnews.com, where he pointed out that Saudi Arabia already has its hands dirty. As a matter of fact, it has its hands very bloody with its military interventions in Bahrain and now terrible bombing campaign in Yemen, thousands of civilian casualties. To hear Bernie Sanders go out of his way again and again to say that the United States needs to egg on and encourage and support Saudi Arabia to cross borders and bomb people, it's really appalling. And so it begs the question, what is Bernie Sanders' view of U.S. foreign policy in that region and, for that matter, military posture and activities internationally? And I think it's disturbing to see how much he feels it is incumbent upon the U.S. to make common cause with and build alliances with this terrible repressive dictatorship, for instance, of Saudi Arabia.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Learn more about the Roots Action Bernie Sanders petition drive by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.